You've touched a tree before. You touched it and walked away. Something you could not see and could not feel started inside your body the moment your hand met that bark. And it was still going 7 days later. And the thing you touched is not what you think it is. The question nobody asks is why. What is a tree doing to your body without a single chemical pill? The answer involves what wood is actually made of, what is happening underneath every forest floor, and why the oldest living thing on earth has never aged a single day. Hold your hand out in front of you. Look at your fingertips. You have touched thousands of things today. A doorknob, a coffee cup, your phone, the fabric of your clothes. You have never touched a single one of them. Not once in your entire life. The electron clouds around the atoms in your skin repel the electron clouds in everything you reach for. Electromagnetic force pushes back across a gap that never closes. What you feel as contact is force across empty space. Every texture you have ever known, every handshake, every surface you have pressed your palm against. Electromagnetic repulsion. Your brain interprets the force as touch. But the gap is always there. So when you put your hand on a tree, your skin does not meet the bark. But something does cross that gap, not through contact, through the air between you. And the physics of what crosses that gap is the first thing nobody ever explains. Trees release molecules into the air around them, not occasionally, constantly. Constantly. These are volatile organic compounds, molecules with low enough molecular mass and high enough vapor pressure to transition from liquid to gas at ordinary temperatures and atmospheric pressure. That is a physics threshold, not a biology one. Whether a molecule becomes airborne depends on intermolecular forces, how tightly the molecules grip each other. Below a certain molecular weight and above a certain vapor pressure, the molecule escapes into the gas phase, alpha pinene, beta pinene, D-limonene, 1,8-cineol. These molecules are light enough and loosely bound enough to float. They have a name, phytoncides, and that word does not mean what people selling essential oils want you to think it means. It was coined in 1928 by a Russian biologist named Boris Tokin, and it literally translates to exterminated by the plant. These are chemical defense weapons. Trees manufacture them to kill bacteria, fungi, and insects that threaten the tree's survival. The tree is not releasing pleasant aromas. It is waging chemical warfare on everything small enough to be destroyed by airborne molecules. Here is the physics that matters. Once these molecules enter the gas phase, they follow the same rules every gas follows. Fick's law of diffusion. Molecules move from regions of high concentration to regions of low concentration along a gradient. The tree is the source. Maximum concentration at the bark surface. The air around the tree is the gradient field. Concentration drops with distance according to an inverse relationship. 1 hectare of pine forest, about 2.5 acres, releases roughly 5 kilograms of phytoncides into the air every single day. 5 kilograms of antimicrobial molecules diffusing outward, sterilizing the atmosphere as they go. Forest air contains 200 to 300 bacterial cells per cubic meter. City air contains thousands. The diffusion field around the tree is, in a measurable sense, a sterilization zone. When you stand near a tree, you are standing inside this diffusion cloud. When you touch the bark, you are at the point of maximum concentration. Your lungs pull roughly 6 to 8 liters of air per minute at rest. Each breath carries these molecules across the thin membrane of your alveoli and into your bloodstream. The physics is simple. Gas phase diffusion into a low-pressure biological system. The consequences are not simple at all. Once these molecules cross into your lungs, something measurable happens. In 2009, a research team led by Dr. Ching Li at Nippon Medical School in Tokyo exposed human subjects to phytoncides and measured what happened to their immune cells over the following weeks. Natural killer cells. A specific class of lymphocyte whose function is to identify and destroy tumor cells and virus-infected cells showed significantly increased activity. Not for hours, not for a day. The increase in natural killer cell activity lasted more than 7 days from a single exposure. Extended exposure over 2 or 3 days in a forest produced effects lasting more than 30 days. The same studies measured adrenaline and noradrenaline concentrations in subjects' urine and found significant reductions. The stress hormones that drive your fight or flight response physically decreased in the presence of these diffusing molecules. Think about that. Molecular compounds following a concentration gradient through an air gap, entering through the respiratory system, and altering the behavior of specific immune cells for weeks. Not relaxation. Not fresh air. Not placebo. Physics. Diffusion physics. Delivering a measurable biological result. But there is a second mechanism operating through the same tree at the same time. Electron transfer. A tree is an electrical conductor. Its root system is in direct contact with the Earth's surface, which carries a net negative charge, a charge maintained by the global electrical circuit, driven by roughly 2,000 active thunderstorms happening at any given moment around the planet. When your conductive skin contacts a grounded conductor, charge flows. Electrons move from the Earth through the tree into your body. A study published in 2013 measured what this does to human blood. Grounding increased the zeta potential on red blood cells, the electrical charge on the cell surface that determines how strongly cells repel one another. Higher zeta potential means your red blood cells spread apart rather than clumping. A measurable change in blood viscosity from electron transfer through a tree trunk connected to the ground beneath your feet. There is a third layer, and this one is a trick your own nervous system plays on you. Thermal conductivity. Wood conducts heat roughly 1,000 times more slowly than metal. When you wrap your hand around a metal railing on a cold morning, the metal rips heat from your skin. It feels freezing. Wood does not do this. Your hand stays warm, and your brain reads that warmth as comfort, as the object giving you something. But the tree is not giving you warmth. It is simply failing to take it. Your nervous system cannot distinguish between an object that provides heat and an object that does not conduct it away. Thermophysics creating a neurological illusion of warmth that has nothing to do with the tree and everything to do with conductivity coefficients. So, three physics mechanisms: molecular diffusion delivering antimicrobial compounds along concentration gradients, electron transfer modifying blood cell charge through a grounded conductor, thermal conductivity generating an illusion of comfort in the somatosensory cortex, all measurable, all operating through the air gap between your skin and the bark. Not metaphor. Physics. Now I want you to think about the tree itself. You have been thinking about what it does to you. Think about what it actually is. A mature oak weighs around 10,000 pounds. Conservation of mass, one of the oldest principles in physics, says that weight came from somewhere. Every atom in that trunk existed before the tree did. So where did 10,000 pounds come from? Well, the obvious answer is the soil. Roots go deep, pull material up, material becomes tree. That feels right. And a man named John Baptist Van Helmont thought so too. In 1648, he designed one of the most elegant experiments in the history of biology. He dried 200 pounds of soil in an oven, weighed it precisely, and placed it in a large earthen pot. He planted a 5-pound willow sapling. Then he covered the pot with a perforated tin lid to keep out dust and airborne debris. For 5 years. 5 years! He watered that tree with nothing but rainwater or distilled water. He kept the system controlled. He was meticulous. When he finally uprooted the tree and weighed everything, the willow had grown to 169 pounds. It had gained 164 pounds of solid mass, bark, wood, roots, branches. He dried the soil and weighed it again. It had lost less than 2 ounces. 164 pounds of mass had appeared, and it had not come from the soil. Van Helmont concluded it must have come from the water. Reasonable guess. Water was the only thing he added. But think about this more carefully. Water is H2O, hydrogen, and oxygen. Hydrogen is the lightest element in the universe. One proton, one electron, almost no mass at all. And wood. The hard, dense structural material of a tree is made of carbon. Carbon is a heavier atom. 6 protons, 6 neutrons, 6 electrons. Roughly 50% of the dry weight of any tree is carbon atoms, not hydrogen, not oxygen. Carbon. Where is the carbon coming from? Not from water. Water contains no carbon. Not from soil. The soil barely changed. All the minerals a tree pulls from the ground, calcium, potassium, magnesium, phosphorus, iron, together account for only 1 to 2% of total dry mass. Trace amounts. The water contributed hydrogen and oxygen, yes. But the carbon, the bulk of the tree, the thing that makes wood hard and dense and structural, did not come from water and did not come from soil. Van Helmont had eliminated two answers. He was stuck. And the right answer was, in the most literal sense, surrounding him. So where did it come from? This is a genuine physics puzzle, and the answer is one of the most beautiful in all of science. It came from a gas, carbon dioxide, CO2, a molecule that makes up just 0.04% of the atmosphere. An invisible trace gas hanging in the air around Van Helmont's experiment the entire time he was running it. Trees pull carbon dioxide through tiny pores on their leaves called stomata. Inside the leaf, they strip the carbon atom from the CO2 molecule, chain those carbon atoms together into glucose, C6H12O6, and release the leftover oxygen. That released oxygen is your breathing air. Every breath you take exists because a tree somewhere stripped carbon from the atmosphere and discarded the oxygen as waste. But the mechanism of that stripping, this is where the physics is remarkable. Put your hand on the nearest wooden surface right now. A desk. A doorframe. A shelf. What you are touching was assembled by starlight. Sunlight is electromagnetic radiation, traveling at 300 million meters per second from a star 93 million miles away. When a photon of the right wavelength, roughly 400 to 700 nanometers, the visible spectrum strikes a chlorophyll molecule in a leaf. It kicks an electron to a higher energy state. That electron has absorbed the photon's energy. It is now unstable, excited, carrying more energy than it should. It enters an electron transport chain, a sequence of molecular machines embedded in the membrane of the chloroplast, and its energy is extracted step by step to build ATP, the universal energy molecule of biology. That ATP then powers the most thermodynamically improbable reaction in the living world, breaking apart carbon dioxide. CO2 is one of the most stable small molecules in nature. The bond between carbon and oxygen is strong. It takes real energy to tear it apart. The ATP provides that energy. The carbon atom is freed from its oxygen partners, and the tree forges it into glucose through new electromagnetic bonds. Carbon to carbon to carbon to carbon. A chain, a structure, a solid. Glucose becomes cellulose, long repeating chains of carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen that form the structural walls of every plant cell. Cellulose becomes reinforced with lignin, a harder, more complex carbon polymer that fills the gaps between cellulose fibers and gives wood its rigidity and its resistance to compression. Electromagnetic energy from a star, captured by a pigment molecule, converted to chemical bond energy holding carbon atoms in fixed positions. That is not a metaphor. That is the molecular mechanism. Photon energy in, solid matter out. A 10,000-pound oak is solidified air. Crystallized atmosphere, built atom by atom from an invisible gas, assembled by captured starlight. Conservation of mass and conservation of energy, both satisfied. Here is the part of this story that I find poignant. Van Helmont. The man who designed that beautiful experiment, the man who proved definitively that the mass did not come from soil, spent years trying to figure out where it went. And the answer was floating invisibly in front of his face the entire time. But here is the twist that makes the story extraordinary. Van Helmont coined the word gas. He derived it from the Greek word chaos to describe the invisible vapors he kept encountering in his chemical experiments. He was the first person in history to recognize that there were different kinds of invisible air, that carbon dioxide was a distinct substance, different from regular atmosphere. He invented the word for the very thing that held his answer, and he still missed it. The man who named gases could not see that a gas was building his tree. Think about that. Every plank of wood in your house, every page of every book you have ever held, every forest on this planet, all of it was once invisible carbon dioxide drifting through the atmosphere. When you touch a tree, you are touching centuries of electromagnetic energy from a star, locked into chemical bonds between carbon atoms pulled from thin air. Here is what that means for you, right now. Every breath you exhale contains carbon dioxide, CO2, leaving your lungs. Some of those carbon atoms were once part of food you ate, which was once a plant, which pulled those atoms from the air, which got those atoms from air. You are exhaling atoms that have been through this cycle before. The carbon in your breath was once a tree, or a blade of grass, or a fern 300 million years old. And the tree you are standing next to right now is pulling some of those atoms back in through its leaves, stripping the carbon, building it into wood. You are breathing out what the tree is breathing in. You are part of the same carbon cycle, the same physics, the same conservation law, running in opposite directions. But you have been thinking about this tree as if it were standing alone, a single organism, a solitary thing rooted in one place. It is not. And this is where the story changes. In the early 1990s, a young forest ecologist named Suzanne Simard was working for the British Columbia Ministry of Forests. Her job was to help improve forestry practices, specifically figuring out how to make replanted clear cuts grow faster. The standard practice at the time was to strip everything, cut the commercial trees, bulldoze the remaining vegetation, plant rows of Douglas fir seedlings in clean soil, and the seedlings kept dying. Nobody could figure out why. They had sunlight, water, soil, space. Everything a tree should need. But they died at rates far higher than seedlings growing in natural forests with all the trees around them. Simard had an idea that her colleagues did not take seriously. She suspected the seedlings were dying because they had been cut off from something underground, something connecting them to all the trees. She proposed that trees in a natural forest were sharing resources through fungal networks in the soil, and that the clear-cut seedlings were starving because the network had been destroyed. Now, you have to understand how this sounded in the 1990s. The prevailing model of forest ecology was competition. Trees compete for light, water, nutrients. The forest is an arena, every tree for itself. The idea that trees were cooperating, sharing carbon, feeding each other, sounded like mysticism, not science. Simard was dismissed. She has talked openly about senior colleagues telling her this work would end her career. She designed the experiment anyway. She went into the forest with plastic bags, syringes, a Geiger counter, and two different radioactive isotopes of carbon, carbon-14 and carbon-13. She covered individual birch and fir seedlings with sealed bags, injected air containing the radioactive CO2, and let the trees photosynthesize the labeled carbon into their tissues. Then she waited. Hours passed. She moved to the neighboring trees, trees that had been growing nearby but had never been exposed to either tracer gas, and tested their tissues with the Geiger counter. The counter clicked. Radioactive carbon was inside trees that had never been given any. Carbon was flowing between trees through underground pathways, not through the air. She had sealed the system. Not through soil water. The isotope signatures were wrong for that. Through something physical, something structural, connecting root system to root system beneath the surface. Simard has described the moment she saw the Geiger counter respond on an unexposed tree. She knew right then. The network was real. The pathways are mycorrhizal networks. Fungal threads, hyphae, thinner than a human hair, that grow from the tips of tree roots and extend outward through the soil, connecting one tree's root system to another's. A single fungal network can span an entire forest. One teaspoon of healthy forest soil contains miles of these threads, a density of connection that makes the network remarkably robust. Now, the topology of these connections resembles what network scientists call a scale-free network, a mathematical structure where a few nodes have enormous numbers of connections while most nodes have few. the same architecture found in the internet, in airline route maps, in the neural connections of a brain. The oldest, largest trees are the hubs, the highest degree nodes. The younger trees are the peripheral nodes connected to them. Kevin Baylor, one of Simard's graduate students, used DNA analysis to map the physical connections in an entire Douglas fir forest. Virtually every tree was linked. The network was not scattered patches of connection. It was one continuous web, and the traffic flowing through this network is not trivial. Paper birch and Douglas fir exchange carbon seasonally. In summer, when young Douglas fir are shaded by the canopy and struggling to photosynthesize, birch trees send carbon through the fungal connections to sustain them. In winter, when birch has dropped its leaves and cannot make sugar, fir returns the favor. The network redistributes resources from surplus to deficit, a kind of equilibration across connected nodes driven by concentration gradients. The same diffusion physics that governs the phytoncides in the air governs the carbon flow underground. But it is not just nutrients. Chemical signals propagate through the network. When a Douglas fir is attacked by insects and sustains tissue damage, it releases defense compounds into the mycorrhizal network. Neighboring trees, including different species connected through the same fungal web, begin producing defense enzymes before the insects have reached them. Information transmitted through a physical substrate, not light, not sound. Chemistry traveling through fungal fiber in the dark beneath the forest floor. The oldest trees in a forest, Simard calls them mother trees, function as the highest degree nodes in the network. They have the most fungal connections, the most resource flow, and they do something that surprised even Simard. They recognize their own offspring, using DNA analysis. Her team mapped which seedlings received the most carbon from which mature trees. Mother trees sent significantly more carbon to genetically related seedlings than to unrelated ones growing at the same distance. They also adjusted their root architecture, physically pulling back their own roots to make space for their seedlings to establish. And when a mother tree is dying, when disease or damage is killing it, it dumps its carbon reserves into the network. A massive pulse of resources pushed outward to the connected trees before the hub goes offline. A final act of distribution from a dying node. Think about that. A tree that recognizes its offspring, feeds them preferentially, makes physical space for them, and when it dies, sends everything it has left into the network for the others. Simard's work has been debated. Some researchers argue the scale and significance of network communication may be overstated in popular accounts, and they have published critiques. Simard and others have published detailed responses. This is how science refines itself: claim, test, counterclaim, new data. But the core finding rests on solid experimental evidence. Trees connect underground through fungal networks. Carbon, water, nutrients, and chemical signals move between them. The network is real. Now, when you touch a single tree, you are not touching an individual. You are touching a node in a distributed system that extends beneath your feet in every direction. The forest floor is a web of biological fiber carrying mass and information between organisms that have been connected for centuries. I told you at the beginning that the oldest living thing on Earth has never aged a single day. Let me tell you what I mean. In the White Mountains of California, in a harsh landscape of wind-scoured rock and thin air, there is a bristlecone pine named Methuselah. It is 4,857 years old. It was a living tree when the Egyptian pyramids were under construction. It has been photosynthesizing continuously through the rise and fall of every civilization in recorded human history. The United States Forest Service keeps its exact location secret because they are afraid of what people might do to it if they could find it. There was another bristlecone pine. It was even older, at least 4,862 years, possibly over 5,000. In 1964, a geography graduate student named Donald Curry was studying glacial history in eastern Nevada. He was coring bristlecone pines to count their growth rings for climate data, standard dendrochronology. His increment borer got stuck in one particular tree. The tool jammed and he could not extract it. He asked the United States Forest Service for permission to cut the tree down to retrieve his equipment and get a sample. They said yes, he cut it down. And only after he began counting the growth rings on the stump, painstakingly, ring by ring, working inward from bark to heartwood, did he realize what he had done. The count went past 1,000, past 2,000, past 3,000, past 4,000. He had destroyed the oldest known living organism on Earth. Nearly 5,000 years of continuous life, a tree that had been photosynthesizing since before the invention of writing, since before the wheel, since before any human civilization that still exists, ended because a coring tool got stuck and a bureaucrat signed a permission slip. Curry never fully recovered from it. He rarely spoke about the incident for the rest of his career. Let that settle. Now, these trees survive not by being strong. They survive by being mostly dead. Bristlecone pines use something called sectored architecture. At any given time, only a narrow strip of bark on the tree is alive, a thin ribbon of living cambium connecting a small section of roots to a handful of green needles. 95% of the tree is dead wood, but that dead wood is so dense and so saturated with resin that it does not rot. It erodes like stone, worn down by wind and ice over millennia, rather than consumed by bacteria. The needles stay on the branches for 40 years, conserving the energy that other trees spend regrowing leaves every spring. The tree sacrificed nearly all of itself to keep a sliver alive. Now here's the question that matters. Why don't trees age? You age. Every animal ages. Right now, as you listen to this, your telomeres, the protective caps on the ends of your chromosomes, are shorter than they were 10 years ago. Every time one of your cells divides, those caps get a little shorter. Your DNA is accumulating copying errors with every division. Your cells are gradually losing the ability to replicate accurately. This is programmed senescence. It is not a disease. It is a feature built into animal biology. You have a clock inside every cell in your body, and it is counting down. Trees do not have this clock. Their meristematic cells, the dividing cells at the tips of every root and branch, replicate indefinitely. The cambium layer, that thin ring of living tissue just beneath the bark, produces fresh wood and fresh bark every year without degradation. Researchers studying ancient bristlecone pines found something remarkable: telomerase activity, the enzyme that rebuilds telomeres. The very thing that wears down in your cells was higher in the oldest trees than in young ones. The older the tree, the more actively it maintained its chromosomes. The cells of a 5,000-year-old bristlecone pine show no molecular indication of knowing how old they are. So what kills them? Stand up for a moment if you can. Feel your weight pressing into the floor through your feet. Feel gravity pulling straight down through your body. Now imagine that force, but amplified by 10,000 pounds of mass, pulling water 300 feet straight up from roots to crown through columns thinner than a drinking straw. Physics kills them, not biology, physics. Wind force scales with surface area, and surface area increases with the square of height. A tree twice as tall catches four times the wind load. In a storm, the bending moment at the base of the trunk increases not just with wind speed, but with the lever arm of the entire crown acting at height. Taller trees don't just catch more wind. They amplify the force through mechanical leverage. Water transport through the xylem, the narrow columns of dead cells that pull water upward purely by tension, no pump, no heart, just the cohesive force of water molecules gripping each other in an unbroken chain from root to leaf, requires increasingly extreme negative pressure as the tree grows taller. At 100 feet, the system is already under significant tension. At 300 feet, the negative pressure approaches what physicists call the cavitation limit, the point where the water literally tears apart, dissolved gases form bubbles, the column breaks, and the transport line fails. This is why the tallest trees on Earth, coast redwoods at roughly 380 feet, are near the theoretical maximum. Not because their biology cannot grow taller, because the physics of water under tension will not permit it. And then there is the square cube law. Mass scales with the cube of height. Cross-sectional strength of the trunk scales only with the square. every inch of growth makes the structure proportionally weaker relative to its own weight. Eventually, the physics accumulates. Lightning finds the tallest point. Wind catches the largest surface. Drought breaks the water columns. Insects exploit the first wound. Fire sweeps through. The structure fails. But the cells, the living, dividing cells in the cambium, those were fine. Those would have kept going. The biology did not fail. The engineering did. The bristlecone pine solved this by refusing to grow. Staying small. Growing slowly, sometimes less than an inch of new wood per century. Sacrificing height and mass and surface area to minimize wind load, minimize water transport demands, minimize structural stress. It traded scale for time. And it worked for almost 5,000 years until a graduate student's tool got stuck. There is something very interesting about this. Every tree on Earth is caught between two forces. Its biology wants to keep going. Cells dividing, cambium growing, life continuing without any internal limit. But its physics is a countdown. Every ring of growth adds mass, adds height, adds surface area, brings the structure one increment closer to the scaling limit where something external will destroy it. Trees are biologically immortal organisms living inside structures that physics will eventually break. Stand next to any tree and think about what you now know, what you're really standing next to. You're touching solidified air. Carbon atoms pulled from the atmosphere and forged into chemical bonds by electromagnetic energy captured from a star 93 million miles away. The wood under your hand is centuries of starlight made solid. And right now, without you feeling a thing, three physics mechanisms are operating on your body through the gap between your skin and that bark. Molecular diffusion is delivering antimicrobial compounds along a concentration gradient, compounds that will alter your natural killer cell activity for the next 7 days. Electrons are flowing from the ground through the trunk into your body, modifying the electrical charge on your red blood cells. And your brain is registering warmth that does not exist. A thermal illusion created by low conductivity coefficients that your nervous system has no way to distinguish from real warmth. Beneath your feet, a scale-free network of fungal threads connects this tree to every other tree around it, redistributing carbon and chemical signals through a web that was operating before you were born and will continue after you are gone. The tree you are touching is not an individual, it is a node. It recognizes its offspring, it feeds them through the network, and when it is dying, it will send everything it has left into the system for the others, and the tree itself, the living cells in its cambium, may be functionally immortal, dividing without degradation. Telomeres rebuilding. No biological clock, no expiration. Limited, not by aging, not by disease, not by any failure of its own cells, but by the square cube law, by wind force, by the cavitation limit of water under tension 300 feet above the ground. Physics writes the death certificate for every tree on Earth. Never biology. You touched a tree once. You touched it and walked away and you thought nothing had changed. Everything had changed. You just could not see it. Neither could Van Helmont, the man who invented the word for what he could not see, who held the answer in the air around him for 5 years and never recognized it. You know, a flower does not become less beautiful when you understand the physics. It becomes something more. And the same is true for every tree you have ever walked past without stopping. Touch one tomorrow. Not because it is spiritual, because it is physics.